Well, I got back from camp this week. Jimmy got back from camp this week. David, did you go to a camp this week?
Camp Pachuto.
Oh, yeah.
That would be awesome if that was a real place. In a grove of walnut trees. You know?
Oh, my goodness. You've already painted the perfect picture. Just me and some walnut trees and a couple wiener dogs.
There you go. Oh, yeah.
Maybe my wife.
I think that's something you could actually make happen. You could charge people a lot of money to go to Camp Pachuto. Interesting. Yeah, well, what have you been up to, David?
I don't want to give too much away. I'll give it away to people who watch the podcast. But the video that I'm working on that's coming out this weekend is pretty much the weirdest picture frame you'll ever see. This is half of it here, so it's...
Whoa. Oh, it's like a piece of a Gothic church.
So there's two pieces, and there's some bent wood in the middle there, and then they form around... I had this walnut cookie that I cut out.
Whoa.
And they're going to form around this. So that's what I've been working on. The video's about experimentation and... just making something for the fun of it and trying new things.
Was that cookie concave on the top?
Yes, yes.
Oh,
yeah. So it kind of has like a shape of an eyeball. It's real.
Is that convex? What, did I say the wrong one?
I don't know. I always get them confused.
Now I gotta look it up.
Yeah. Okay. It's like
Is that done on a lathe or is that a CNC?
This what I don't want to give too much away. How about that?
Okay. Sounds good.
So CNC. That center part was very shiny. I hate glossy furniture, but I thought for this piece, since I want that frame that's going to fit around this weird shape, I thought, well, maybe I'll make it shiny. But it's cut out of end grain walnut, and as soon as I put on the glossy epoxy coating, it just turned really black and dark. And so I think I might sand off the shiny and go back to my normal, typical dull finish. So still working on it, but yeah, this video is about just experimenting, creating art, trying some new things. And the frame part was more difficult than I thought, because trying to reinforce these weird joints that with the comes out of a curve. This is like a bet lamination curve in the center here, but then we reinforced all the joints in the back, and I did route a rabbet all along the back, because I don't know if I haven't decided if this piece, it's three pieces that's going to fit together, if it's going to have a colored back or if it's just going to be the wall showing through. But but routing that rabbit gives me the option to play with colors here. So that's what I'm doing today.
I have a question, but before I ask you that question, concave means hollowed out or rounded inward and can be easily remembered because these surfaces cave in.
All right.
Yeah.
So there's your mechanism.
Thank you. Somebody was already yelling at their podcast player.
Oh, yeah. You idiots.
Idiots.
Why don't you know that?
You guys don't deserve a podcast.
Yeah.
No, honestly, okay, so. I remember learning that as a kid in school. Concave means cave because it's in, and vex means out because it's the opposite of the other one.
I don't think I ever heard that, but it totally makes sense. So
yep.
Now I know. Cool. So the question I have is, you do a lot of this type of like, you have an artistic idea. The end goal is art, and there's an experimentation. The video is about an experimentation to get to that art. How do you think about titling? And I don't even know how to ask the question. How do you think about titling art? How do you think about titling experimentation? Because you could have one title that effectively covers all of the videos that are that process. You know what I mean? Like, how do you make them unique but still get the idea that this is an experiment across?
So, to be honest with you guys, over the last maybe year and a half or so, I've gone through two like YouTube guru courses, really trying to like up my YouTube game and compete with the kids. And through all that, I found some things that worked very well and some videos that really took off, but I hate those videos. They are not me. They feel like it's a YouTube views grab, you know, like reviewing Facebook ads and stuff. Like you want to make those videos. Those are great. Those are entertaining to watch, but they don't feel like it's contributing to what I want to make as a whole. So over the last month and a half, I have just decided, if I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out making the things that I want to make. And I have not cared about too much about thumbnails, titles, and views. I'm really trying to stick with, like, I want to make these things. If it works, that's amazing. If it doesn't work, I'm going out the way I want to go out. So that's where I'm at. And so, you know, a couple of videos ago, it was like the title of the video was something like Woodworkers Love Overkill. And then, you know, the last video was Designed Better by Throwing Away the Game Plan. So basically what I'm doing is I'm filming the projects without talking too much while filming. And then I'm working on a voiceover. So it's actually very scripted now. And then I'm trying to find a story, or I'm trying to find an experience that either I just experienced or something from my younger self. I'm trying to give a little bit more story, and I will pull the title out of that experience. Right. And that's where we're at right now. Okay. So maybe in a few months I'll panic because nobody's watching my videos, and I'll work on it more. But for right now, we are trying to get, I just want to, like, I'm at, like, my last, I haven't reached, I had this idea what I want the videos to look like. And it's really hard to pivot from, like, step-by-step how-to. This is how we've done this for 10 years. And now I'm trying to do this little more artsy thing. And so it's hard to make what's in my head actually come out of my computer. So, but the last video was pretty close. And I think this video might be even a little closer, but it's we always worried about, like, can you actually see what I'm doing in this camera shot? Maybe we should bring the camera up a little bit more so you can see what's on the bench. Maybe I should talk through what I'm doing more so you can understand exactly what I'm doing. Now it's not, I'm not making videos for woodworkers. I'm making videos for people who want to be inspired or just want to see cool stuff being made. Or maybe they can pick up a visual trick on their own. And so, like, okay, let's bring the camera down lower because they don't need to see every little detail. Let's focus on what looks good on camera, what's going to work well in a video. And that's where we're at. If you don't like that, that's perfectly fine. A lot of people are not going to like that. But I think the people who like my content, I think are really liking that. So I think I'm making videos for my audience who really likes what I do. I'm just going to try to build that audience. That was a long explanation of what you're going to title the video, but that's where I'm at mentally. I'm going to go out with a bang. Great.
And I think that makes a lot of sense, because I think the question was born from the problem of title thumbnail stuff, mm-hmm. right? The problem of title thumbnail is that it's difficult. And if you care about it, if you make an effort for it, it is hard to redo that every time. And it would be easier if there's a sensationalism to the project. We talked about this before. Like, if I'm digging a tunnel under my house, then yeah, that's a great title. You don't have to work too hard at that.
Right.
But if you're like, well, I was going to say, if you did a bunch of videos about digging tunnels under your house, but we know that that works for Colin as well. But, but you know, if you have like a process that is a little less, you take the proper nouns out of a title and the process is the same, it can be difficult to figure out how to re-explain that, to re-engage somebody over the course of several videos that effectively are the same with different nouns. Mm-hmm. That's what I've run into. So I was curious how you did that, but you're subverting that completely, and you're done. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
The thing is, since I've gone through these courses, it's kind of ruined some videos for me, because I will watch a video and I'm like, that's the tactic. That's the thing that the gurus teach, you know? And I'm like, ugh. And so I know too much, and it makes me feel a little ill. Much. Yeah. And the last two videos ago, I had to do, like, I was running out of time, so I had to do something quickly. So I thought I'd make like five tools that you could make. And so we just used the cheap tools in the budget shop to make like a tri-square and a mallet and just a little block plane. And even that one was like, man, I'm just making this video just to make a video. It benefits a lot of people because they can take the free plans that I provided and make those tools, but it's not contributing to the overall thing that I really want to work towards.
Yeah. I think we're all doing that. Jimmy, you can speak for yourself. I can see you doing that, trying to contribute toward the thing that you want to accomplish. I feel like I'm doing that, although I don't know if it's obvious from the outside. But that kind of like recentering on the goal, refocusing on the thing and the core of what we want to be doing, why we got into this in the first place, even if that thing has changed a little bit, but recentering past the mechanisms we have to work within and the game of it all. And kind of, you know, I think a lot of people right now, the two of us, Jimmy, you can speak for yourself again, but I think we're recentering and refocusing from the game of it to the core of it, to the heart of it. And I see a lot of other people doing that. And I think there's a lot of young creators right now who are starting there.
Mm-hmm.
Like all the people we've talked about, Jake Frew and all those like filmmaking people who are just making films because they want to make a pretty film.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it doesn't have anything beautiful to say, but a lot of them do. I think those people are starting there, and I hope they stay there, you know, because
right.
They missed the Mr. Beastification of what they were doing, but there will be something next. There will be another swing with how to get popular. And I hope that those people and us can like avoid the temptation to try to tailor to the new game.
Yeah.
Whatever that ends up being, you know,
one of the things that I'm still struggling with is the tone when I do the voiceovers. And when I play back the videos, it sounds like me doing a voiceover. And maybe it contributes to like nobody really likes hearing their own voice because it always sounds weird when it's played back. I thought I got over that. But when I do a voiceover here in the office, it still feels a little weird to me. So I've been watching some videos on how to speak to a camera, and I picked up a couple little tips, and it's mostly it comes like it should come across more as like you're talking to a single person instead of a camera lens. And so I do think my storytelling and my videos are going to get better, because it's like the improve each time is something that you preach, like get better each time. So I'm trying to do that, and that's why it's one of the reasons why the videos are not coming out exactly how I see them in my head, because people like Jake Frew, their videos are cinematic. When he does his voiceovers, or people like him do their voiceovers, it sounds authentic. He's pulling a story from an experience, and I really want to get into that. And you can't just nail it on your first try. Like I've done how-to step-by-step videos for 10 years, and now I'm trying to do this weird pivot, and it's almost irritating that it doesn't come out the way I want it. But I guess that's how art works.
I was walking through Hobby Lobby or something the other day, and there was like a piece of like house art on the wall, and it said, "Practice makes progress, not perfect." And I was like, I've heard that before and I forgot it. That's awesome. But that's exactly what you're saying, is like you're practicing and it's getting better. You know? Yeah, that's cool. Jimmy.
Yeah.
What do you think about all this? You haven't said anything because we've been talking.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
No, okay, because my mic, I just looked down and my mic had a weird adjustment indication on it. I'm doing good. I went, since we last all spoke, I went to North Carolina. I went to a town called Tuxedo, North Carolina. It has a more proper name, which I can't remember, but Tuxedo. And coincidentally, I went down to Tuxedo, North Carolina, south of Asheville by about 60 miles. It also, there's a Tuxedo, New York, and Max, who invited me down to Camp Arrowhead, told me this is named after a tuxedo that's in New York, and it's not too far from me. So every year in New York State, in Tuxedo, New York, there's a Renaissance Fair. That's why it's popular. Everybody knows the Tuxedo Renaissance Fair commercials. But besides that, I went down to North Carolina to Camp Arrowhead to do a weekend live and in person emulation of this TV show where there was about 70 kids. And I checked in with Max. I said, can I bring the kids anything? I said, can I make slingshots? So I made 70 slingshots to bring down there, so with the rubber and the leather laser cut and CNC slingshot handle. And I brought them down for the kids to put together. So that was a big hit. But what we did was we broke the kids into teams, four teams, and gave them paper, and they had to brainstorm up something that the camp would need. What can the camp use? You all have to brainstorm. And I went around to the tables. They had about an hour to brainstorm together as a team. And that was amazing. I was telling you guys before we started, I personally never went to camp, but I could see what an amazing character building event it was. And also socializing, how important socializing is with other kids and how the kids get along. And you could see the comedians in the crowd. You could see the scientists in the crowd. You could see, you know, the firemen and the policemen. You could see these kids where they're going to go, you know, at least vaguely. And it was such a wonderful experience for me to watch the kids create and think. And it's funny to watch the kid go from being pouty because his idea is not being selected to immediately flipping and becoming part of the team. Mm. You could like see that moment where like the one thing you say or do sparks that kid's like, okay, I'm still included, even though my idea is not the one we're going to go with. And it was pretty amazing to do that. And we had the four teams come up and do a pitch to the camp counselors, and together we chose. And if you see my stories, you see the one story. There's a ritual, and check this out. This camp's been in business since 1936 or something. It's obviously gone through several owners, but now Max owns it, and his family is sort of a family business. His mother was there, his wife is there. Everyone's like hands-on, full-time. And there's a thing called the pothole, and it's amazing. The kids all want to get potholed. And the story is, and Max, I hope I'm saying this correctly, years ago, it might not have been that camp, but there's several camps in the area. When you drive, you see different entrances to different camps. And this is on 180 acres, so there's lots of room to run around in. And wow. One of the camps had a sinkhole that was full of water, kind of like, you know, I think it's called the cenote in Mexico. It's just like a hole in the ground where you could swim in. It's not really a lake. It's just like a weird geological formation. And one of the camps had this thing. They called it the pothole, and it was like a 20-foot wide hole that was about 20 feet deep, or maybe 10 feet wide, 20 feet deep. And an act of courage was to see if you could swim to the bottom and touch the bottom. Now, nobody would be allowed to do that at all because it's obviously too dangerous. So in the early part of the century, this was like an act of courage at one of these camps. So if you did the pothole, you swam to the bottom. So that morphed into getting a bucket of water dumped on your head, a bucket of ice cold water.
Interesting.
So okay. In like the last 20 or 30 years, so maybe even longer, I even think maybe in the 50s, it was already now you get a bucket of water dumped on your head.
Yeah.
So there's a spinning wheel and certain rituals throughout the day. The kids spin the wheel, and if they get potholed, they have to get, and everyone goes bananas. The kids go nuts. You got to get a bucket of water dumped on your head. And so they had this big cooking pot. It was about 10 gallons of water. And one of the teams said, let's make a pothole station where the water can dump on your head. And I manipulated the invention a little bit, but the kids did naturally come up with it, which was funny because Justin, one of the main guys there, said, he goes, I want to kind of push the kids towards this if they don't come up with anything better. It was his idea too, but the kids naturally came up with it right away. Every team thought of it, but they all ended up going with their own thing, and this one team stuck with it. And that was the one thing we picked. And so if you see on my stories, this weird contraption looks like a big electric chair with a crank, and a big giant cooking pot spills icy water on people. That was one of the teams came up with that. And we built that on Sunday morning, and it was great because the kids rotated through. I couldn't have them all there at the same time. And I was holding the drill. They were young. I mean, some of these kids were as young as 6 years old. So I was holding the drill for them and having them pull the trigger and installing the screws and helping me carry the wood. It was a really, really, really great experience for me. And I told you guys before we started, it's the first time since I did this TV show on Netflix called Making Fun, where I actually did this stuff with kids in person. And because of this, it was so much fun. I got really good footage. They got footage. I've been talking to the producers. I'm like, we got some of this footage I just shot. If we can revive this idea with real people in real space now that COVID's not around, which is the whole reason we did the whole show through a television set, does the show have legs with you know, teams of kids in real spaces and really doing inventing. Anyway, after all said and done, it was a really wonderful weekend. We ended up with this crazy device which dumps water. And Max and Justin ran around the farm just looking for different scraps we could put together. We got an old wheel off of a trailer and cut the tire off it. We found a fence post that became our axle. He had this cranky device which was used to roll a log, and we ended up welding it to the thing. It was just all came together really, really well in just 48 hours. So I got there Friday night, left Sunday night, and in those 48 hours, we really got a lot accomplished, and the kids really had a lot of fun. So it kind of reinvigorated my whole thought process about this concept. Every day I get emails and questions. Hey, when can my kids be on the show? Well, this is a great show. I'm sick of watching 8 episodes. When can we see more? Obviously, there's not going to be any more unless somebody steps up and decides to make it. And I say somebody, I mean a network. There's always conversations in the background about doing an independent TV show, raising the money and doing it, mm-hmm. putting it on YouTube. But I don't know. There has to be so many things in line for that to really take place, including, of course, the money. But so I did that, and that was a great experience. And then this week, I'm working on my go-kart. My go-kart event is July 13th. I'm afraid to promote it because I don't want too many people that I can't handle there. But July 13th in East Durham, you don't have to bring a go-kart. There's no real competition. I have some people asking me, they say, what do I have to, like, what are the parameters of the event? I'm like, just show up.
How many people do I have to defeat?
yeah. Like, are there heats? Is like, what are the ramps? I'm like, no, just come with a go-kart. We just buzz around. We just share ideas.
Are missiles allowed?
Yeah. We trade tools. You know, everyone, I always encourage, this doesn't really take too much, this doesn't get too much traction, but I always say, bring stuff, trade stuff. If you have anything you want to give away, bring stuff to give away. And people will also have stuff to give away. And that usually ends up being a couple of pallets worth of junk people sift through to take home. I always put out it's funny, Rob and I, when we start cleaning up around this time, it's like, racetrack. And then three pallets full of just giveaway materials and tools.
Making the piles.
Yeah. So that's coming up. This year, I opted to buy a go-kart. I bought a go-kart from a friend in the area. I posted on Instagram. Mike, thank you for the go-kart. And the steering is always such a pain in the butt, doing the whole steering situation. So I was like, let me just start from a full go-kart rather than scratch. And that's what I'm doing. So yesterday I was cutting the go-kart apart, making it longer for my big legs. And I'm going to do some customization, probably more cosmetic than performative, because these guys make these go-karts that go 70 miles an hour. I'm like, I don't want to go 70 miles an hour under a car. I want to just buzz around the track at, like, you know, this isn't like Dave, you have a real competitions. So we're just going around, go, wow, that was fun. Wow. You know, maybe you could spin a tire. That would be cool. Like in the leaves, that would be fun.
In the leaves.
Yeah. My buddy Art Clement, who's, I call him the chairman of the event. He's there every year. He'd make a go-kart that on hot, dry pavement, you could spin the tires. He's insane with his performance. He's a mechanic and a well-trained small engine mechanic and car mechanic and welder and designer. He makes insane. This year, he's made three things for this year's event. He's working on a mini bike right now, but he made a pull-along wagon, like a radio flyer wagon. Is that a radio flyer wagon, the wagon?
Yeah.
He put an engine on the wagon and it does wheelies. So it's like a little, you sit in the wagon and it, like the distribution of, I think the engine is in the front. I don't know how he did it. But he's like, he could hang a wheelie on the thing. He's like scooting around on a wheelie, leaning on the wheelie bars. So this event seems like this one is going to be a real big one. I'm excited. I'm excited and nervous at the same time. Bring a helmet. No one's allowed on the track without a helmet this year.
And a pen to sign a waiver.
I have an open waiver when you walk through the fence, but I don't know how long that would, I don't know how that would hold up at court. But yeah, just come and be careful and have fun, safe time. If you come, just come and hang out and say hi. You don't have to bring anything. Bring hot dogs. Last year when everybody left, I had a freezer full of hot dogs. You want to hear a funny, gross story? So this year, so at the end of July, at the end of the event last year, I had probably 50 pounds of hamburgers and hot dogs because everybody brings stuff and we don't eat it all. People say, what can I bring? I'm like, just bring a pack of hamburgers or bring a pack of hot dogs, right? So some people overcompensate and they bring like, you know, much more than anybody could eat. So I have a freezer downstairs. So I have a deep freeze. So I have the deep freezer downstairs filled with meat. And one day I go down in my basement. So now it's July, August. Now it's like December. And I hadn't eaten hardly any of the stuff down there, but it's in a deep freeze. And I'm like, I know I just have to give it to the birds or something. I can't really eat all of it. But I go downstairs in like December, January, and I'm like, uh-oh, something smells down here. I must have a dead animal down here. And I see like a trickle of blood. I'm like, what is this blood? And I follow the trickle of blood back to the freezer. And I see that the plug got kicked out by something or somebody. And the freezer has been unplugged for what probably has been like 2 months.
Gross.
And it's full of meat.
And you got to open it in a closed room.
I put a ratchet strap on it so it will accidentally
fall over. I was going to say, yeah, just tape it shut and drag it out.
And I couldn't touch it. I couldn't go near it. I was so skeeved out. And I had to ask my friend Mike, who's a fireman, who's, you guys all know Mike the fireman. Mike has been to hell and back. He's been on the fire department for 20-something years. So I said, Mike, I don't ask you for much. I said, could you please do me a favor and get rid of that refrigerator? I said, I swear there's not a person in it.
He goes, no problem. It's full of meat, but not people.
I said, it's ratchet. I go, it's ratchet strapped shut. Don't worry about it. He's like, no problem.
Ignore the blood that's coming out of it.
Yeah.
Oh, no problem. Trickle. I texted him because I was away when he's like, hey, he's like, you need anything this week? I said, yeah, the only thing I need is for you to get rid of that refrigerator.
That's amazing that you just decided to not open it and just like.
Oh, I didn't even look at it because I just knew.
Yeah.
If there was blood coming out of the corner of a sealed.
Yeah.
You know, it's like what it's like a long term drop in box. I mean, I had it so we can keep frozen dog food in it.
Okay. You're like, this is not mine anymore.
And I said, when I got home, I drove past my shop, which I have a dumpster at my shop down the block. And I drove past and I see the refrigerator just sticking out of the dumpster. I was like,
oh my gosh.
With a brand new ratchet strap around. I said, Mike, thanks. I said, the police are going to open this up and go, how did he turn a human being into 70 hamburgers? I don't understand.
I've always heard, I don't know if this is true or not, I've always heard that ground beef like that, unless you're like butchering an animal and you just take the chunk and you just lay it on the thing, the red that comes off of processed meat is not blood. It's a protein. It's like water with this protein that ends up being red in it. Is that correct?
That is correct. I forget what the name is, but yeah, the red juice is coming out is not blood.
So they would test that.
What is it?
I don't know. Some sort of protein water.
Somebody's yelling at their podcast player again.
Yeah.
Same person.
That's all right. Concave. Ooh. Convex.
Protein, well, not blood.
That is a truly gross story. I'm glad.
Yeah, that was a gross one. So that was a consequence of the previous year's go-kart event. But yeah, it's going to be fun. It's really shaping up to be a good one. And by the way, every year I usually do it around the July 4th weekend, and people get cranky because they have family things and obligations. They can't make it, and they get all cranky. So now it's on the 13th. So I'm expecting a bigger crowd because people don't have those family obligations that they had in the previous four years.
You moved the date because it always would happen on Bob's birthday, and you really wanted That's Bob right. to come to this one.
That's exactly right, Bob. No excuses. He's like, not yet. Let me think of one.
I have excuses.
I'm just needling you.
Yeah, planning anything around my schedule is a bad idea. Yeah,
of course.
Cool. Well, I'm glad the camp went well.
The camp was a great time, and I told Max, I said, I'm looking forward to coming back if they'd have me. It was great. It was really great.
That was something I went to. I went to one of the one camp that was like that. It was like our church had this thing called RAs, and it was basically, it was Royal Ambassadors, and it was Boy Scouts in church is essentially what it was. And so we had one camp. Maybe I went a couple of times, but basically it was a week-long camp out in cabins, you know, bunk beds with a bunch of elementary school boys. You do all the outdoor fun stuff. You learn how to cut things with a knife. You learn how to clean a fish. You know, you do all that type of stuff. And that was, you said before we hit record that how formative something like that could be. And I totally agree. that was a formative experience for me, being outside. And I think part of that was being outside and doing those things without my parents, which is really interesting because my dad used to take us fishing. Like, we grew up, I don't know, 200 yards from a lake, and my cousins and stuff would go fishing all the time. So, like, we fished and we were outside some. We camped some, we went canoeing, and those were important experiences for me too. But doing that stuff at a place without my parents, I think, gave me some ownership over my own ability to clean a fish, you know, not like helping my dad clean a fish, like that's useful. And so, yeah, I think that camp experience, or some sort of camp experience where you're doing new things without your parents, without the teachers that you know, without the authority figures in your life to guide you through them, it really helps you kind of stand out on your own, to yourself. You know, it builds some confidence in you. So
it was funny. Like I said to you guys earlier before we started, I was watching the kids, and you could see where the kids, their confidence starts to develop. And I was amazed at the bonding that these 60 or 70 kids had amongst each other. And they had only met shortly previous few days earlier than that for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, they were all from all around the country, even a couple of kids from Europe. And first time they met, and they were all like good buddies at this point. You know, it's a camp for boys. It's just a couple of girls. The girls that were there were Justin's daughters, who were adorable. So they're blacksmithing. There's a blacksmithing. There's a bushcrafting thing. Justin does a really great bushcrafting thing where the kids are weaving reeds into baskets, making bark into baskets, making arrows, making arrowheads with obsidian. It's really a great. They said most of the camps around there kind of focus on sporting. They want to focus on crafts. So it's really, really, they're doing a really beautiful job. And all the kids go home with an arrowhead that they blacksmith themselves. I'm in the blacksmith shop, and there's like a 6-year-old kid swinging a hammer at like something like scorching red hot. And it's nice to see people aren't overly cautious. No one's hovering. You know, the kids all get a lesson. They all have to wear glasses, and they all get a lesson on safety, and then they just go. It's not this constant reassurance of like, don't do this, be careful, don't do that. And not one kid got hurt at the blacksmith shop. Where on I do it with adults, you always see somebody with the hand in the bucket. They're like, yeah, I grabbed the wrong end, you know. Obviously it's an eventuality, but it was just nice to see these kids for the very first time. Those previous couple of hours got the talking to about the blacksmith shop, and now they're here helping each other. You know, the older kids are helping the younger kids. It was just a really great, and I personally have never been to camp. So for me, it was a real good experience. I hung out with the kids the entire time. I never went back to my room. There was nothing to do except just hang out. And I went and blacksmithed. You know, I had a window of opportunity to do what I wanted. And the kids have this opportunity where they can go and do different stations. There's obviously several destinations, and they're all kind of far to walk to. And it's up to them. They're like, for this many hours. And there's a huge bell. So you ring the bell, and you could hear the bell throughout the whole camp. When the bell rings, it's like time to come back to whatever the next activity is. Come back for roll call or whatever. But it was a great experience for me.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I went to a camp called, at that time, it was called Camp Store, which was in Jackson, Michigan. And I just looked it up now. It's now called like YMCA Store Camp. So it looks like it was bought out by YMCA, but there has to be some other people listening to this podcast who also went to Camp Store in Michigan. And it was, I think Bob nailed it. It was like probably that first experience of being away from guardians, no parents, no grandparents for a week. I was with my classmates, but it was also I remember when we got there, you were mixed with other schools as well. And so you're around a bunch of strange kids. I remember we had to do a play. We had to come up with a whole story, and we did the whole boating, making tents and stuff like that. And it was just that wonderful experience of like being away from parents and learning how to do stuff on your own. Cause I'd never realized that until just now, but yeah, helping dad is different than doing the thing on your own, maybe with somebody else.
Yeah, which as a dad is crushing to know,
right?
You know what I mean? But at the same time, it's actually pretty awesome. I mean, it's crushing to know that eventually they will do better without you around to a point to get to like some development. But so I know that Josh, I talked to Josh recently about his son, his oldest son went to a camp, and his son hasn't been a go be social in a place that he doesn't know anybody and go outside and do a thing, right? That's just not something he would have typically done. He decided to go to this camp with a bunch of people in like another state somewhere. It was pretty far away. Came back a different kid, loved it, had a blast, like got to do all these new things, met all these new people, had just totally new experience. And so that was really good for him. Same kind of thing last year. This time last year, my two oldest kids went on a mission trip with our church, with the youth group, and they went to Costa Rica. And so on this, it was the first time them really leaving us for any significant amount of time. First time traveling out of the country without us. Well, I mean, at all, but without us. And they went down there to this group of a bunch of kids, went down to work with a mission that was building homes for single mothers in that area. And so incredible. They went down working with a construction crew that was already building the house. They were labor. You know, it was just like somebody would tell, somebody would tell them, we need these blocks moved from here to here. We need you to clear out all this brush. You know, it was just like, do the work. And I mean, they were, you know, young teens at the time. They came back different people. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. In a good way. Separate experience from us, you know, doing labor and doing work that they had never had any reason to do before. So this past week, while you were at camp, I went on a mission trip again with this same group of kids as an adult. And I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about this because talking about doing service work feels a little bit like, hey, I did some good stuff, guys. You know, it feels like that kind of like, but that's not the point. The point was my two kids were going on this trip, and the church does an international mission 1 year, and then they do a domestic mission the next year, and they go back and forth to make it accessible for people and help different people. So we went to Tennessee. They asked me to go because they know that I build stuff, and both my kids were going, so it was a great opportunity to go be with them. So we drove to Tennessee, a few hours away. We camped for a week at a campground, like a you know, legit campground, not just like out in the woods. And then went, and we had five teams of six or seven kids. I was one of the leaders for one of the groups, and we went to different homes of elderly or disabled people and helped build accessibility ramps and fix things on their houses and stuff like that. So my team went to this house, this lady named Georgie, who is super sweet and didn't have a lot of mobility. And so we took down a very old, dangerous deck off one side of her house and completely rebuilt it. And it was basically like two decks with two ramps. Huge amount of work. Huge amount of work. And we did that on one side of the house. Another team fixed her flooring inside of her house, did put down vinyl plank flooring, shored up the foundation, did some work. Wow. But it was a lot of improvement to really just help somebody be able to get around a little bit easier if they need to. And that was just one location. There were several other locations. But the point of all this is that I got to be on the side of my kids were there, but I was kind of working with them, and I got to see them do this stuff and teach them how to use tools. But I also got to see a bunch of other kids that are not my kids. That was really cool because I had this group of six or seven teenagers who had never used tools before, had never built anything, had never taken the kind of direction that you have to take when it's like, I'm laying out posts for a deck and it matters where they are, stuff like that. And man, these kids came alive. They just were responsive and eager to help and to build and to put in hard work. And it was 95 degrees. We were in full sun the whole time. We were sleeping in tents. Like it was not.
How far did you go from where you live?
It's about 3 hours. Not really that far, but it's like almost an entirely different world.
Yeah.
Eastern Kentucky, Eastern Tennessee, in the kind of Appalachian area are historically low income, kind of remote areas that, you know, it's easy for people to get lost there, especially elderly people, disabled people. They get lost. They get left behind. And so a lot of the work that our group has done in the past several years, that this is the first one I've been a part of, but they go to those places and they work with some local agencies to find people who are, who just have like a need that needs to be addressed, you know? And so then, it's a way for us to just help somebody. And it was awesome. But watching these kids take a little bit of direction about, you know, I would say, here's how you use the saw, you know, don't push it into the wood until the blade is fully spun up, just stuff like that, you know? And then I would like, let them do it. And man, they all took to it. My oldest son, I don't even know that I did it. He set up a miter saw station and was cutting deck boards for everybody. So people would measure their spot, take a board to him, tell him what they needed. He would set it up, chop it, you know, chop it, move on. And he was just like this assembly line, helping everybody else do their tasks. It was so cool to watch. And he felt so like this is my station and I'm being productive and I'm helping these people do those specific things. And it was so cool, man. It was such a good time. And we had, you know, of course, outside of the work, I got to know these kids. These are my friends' kids. Like, my daughter's boyfriend was on my team, so I got to actually get to know him and see how hard of a worker he is. And then we got to do fun stuff. We swam in the river at the end of every day after being all hot. We went and played in the river, and we went rafting at the end of the trip, which was great. But after camping with my kids last weekend or 2 weeks ago, whenever that was, and just feeling that invigorated to be outside, I thought, well, after a week of that and hard work, I'm probably not going to want to go camping for a while. But fact of the matter is, like, I left this trip going, I need to be outside a whole lot more. Like, I need to go camp. Yeah. I need to go bike. I need to go kayak. I need to go canoe. I need to be outside because it's, you know, it's doing stuff for me in a good way. So it was a really, really good week in a lot of different ways. And as weird as this sounds to say out loud, I did not miss making videos or social media or worrying about ad revenue or sponsors. I didn't miss any of that stuff a single bit. Not even like almost the opposite, you know what I mean? Like, it was surprising how quickly I was able to detach from all of that stuff to be, and I'm happy about this, that I could totally be in what I was in that moment, in that, for that week. And I know you can't live there, right? You can't live in a place that doesn't make you any kind of money. Like, I get that. But it was surprising at how quickly I could set all that aside and just be fully engaged in those people, in what we were doing, in wilderness, and man, it was good. It was really good. Yeah. So I hope that week was for the kids that I was working with and for my kids. I hope it was what you're talking about, Jimmy. I hope it was a time that was formative and challenging and new and stuff for them. And I hope, like, I got to be a part of the other side of that for them, which I think was really cool. So, I don't know.
I look back and I think about all the cool field trips we went in elementary school. Like, we, you know, we were in Toledo. We would travel to Columbus, 2+ hours away, to go to a science museum called COSI. And I was just like, that was so amazing. And it's very unfortunate that schools do less field trips because the money's not there, and there's less industrial arts and less metal shop and less woodworking stuff, and there's less just hands-on doing and seeing stuff. And I think back on all that stuff, and I'm like, that was such a great experience. It really kind of shaped my childhood.
Yeah, I mean, it's exposure to stuff that you just don't normally see. We got an email recently that one of my kids, his class is taking a trip to DC, which is, that's like 8 or 9 hours from us. And it's, you know, at the end of next year, they're planning now for them to take this trip to DC. And he was kind of like, I don't know if I want to go to the, and I'm like, no, you're going to DC without me. You're getting, because you'll love it. You'll love staying in a hotel and going to see all these monuments and stuff that you will not get exposed to otherwise, because, you know, we don't take trips like that to go see historical stuff because of soccer and because of all these other things. And if you have the opportunity to go on a guided experience through DC, which is just full of so much. Like, yes, you're going to go and you're going to love it. You won't know until you get there. But yeah, I agree. That stuff doesn't, it's a shame that that stuff doesn't happen as often for as many kids. But
you guys want to hear, you just remember, I'm sitting here thinking of the school trips that I went on. One school trip I went on, which was amazing, was the King Tut exhibit came to the Museum of Natural History in Manhattan.
I did that too in Chicago. Yeah.
And my elementary school brought us. It must have been like 1977, 76. We went and saw, and I didn't understand the significance at the time. And I think, I could be wrong, but I think me and Rachel were just looking this up, and I think I remember it saying, because I'm helping Rachel do some stuff about Egypt. The King Tut's tomb was the only tomb so far in the history of modern times that they found that was not raided in antiquity.
Yeah.
It was only raided in modern times. It's the only, it's a joke, but it's the only tomb that they found that was unmolested in all of this time. So you think of like how insane that they found exactly what they buried there 3,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And now it's sitting in Manhattan. You know, well, it goes on tour. Obviously, it's all back in Cairo now, but it was on tour, and to go and see that in person was amazing. And then when I was in high school, I went to, a lot of people know this about me, for 3 years in high school, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, I went to architecture school for half the day. In Long Island, they called it BOCES. It was, you go for trade school. So I spent half the day in architecture class. And I had two architect teachers that were very, again, very, very formative for me. They really set a lot of parameters for me that still last today as far as design aesthetics and design interests. And my one teacher, it must have been 1984, 83, we went to Manhattan to go see Trump Tower, because Trump Tower had just sort of opened. It probably had been open for like 2 years at that point. But we went to do a tour of Trump Tower. We went into the lobby, took the escalators all around and saw the pink marble inside and went to the different shops. We took a bus to Manhattan to just walk around inside Trump Tower.
Huh.
With my architecture class, which was amazing at the time.
So, I had a...
40 years ago.
A thing when I was 16, I guess. And this was another one of those, like, away from my parents' formative experiences. I was in marching band, played trumpet, and I got some, it sounds fancy, but I got an invitation to go on this trip. But it was just like, if you pay, you get to go on the trip. It's not because I was good or anything. But basically, we flew out of Atlanta, so we had to drive to Atlanta right after Christmas. A bunch of teenagers who were musicians flew to London for a week. And the whole point of the trip was to march through London for a New Year's Day parade and then end up at the Royal Albert Hall, which is, if you don't know the Royal Albert Hall, it's like...
How old were you when you did this?
The place. I was 16.
Wow.
And so we marched... And then we got to the Royal Albert Hall. We went in, played on the stage in Royal Albert Hall, and then that was the trip. And so the rest of the trip was just about like practice and touring things. We went to Cambridge. We went to Oxford. We went to all these different places. And I was 16, and it was the first time I had ever really – it was the first time I had left the country, but first time I had really gone on anything outside of that, you know, without my parents. And it was huge for me. It was huge. And it was like what you were talking about, where you meet these people that you've never met before and you're immediately close to them. But going on that trip exposed me to an entirely different country within some boundaries. You know, it wasn't just like loose. But man, there were so many memories that came out of that. The funny thing is, I thought it was going to be some like, you know, we're going to play some complex music and we're going to show these, you know, British people, how good musicians we are. We played Rocky Top, Tennessee. And what was the other song? It was something else like that. It's like, you know, beginning band, sixth grader music, like the most basic thing you could possibly play. So we're like marching through London playing Rocky Top, which was just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then we got on the stage of the Royal Albert Hall. And as we're going in the back entrance, there's this kind of round hallway that goes around the back of it, where I guess all the green rooms, you know, for the talent and stuff. And you're going down this hallway and there's pictures on the walls of all these people playing on the stage that we're about to walk onto. And it's like Jimi Hendrix, The Beatles, Rolling Stones, just like everybody, Eric Clapton, everybody you can imagine. Pictures of them on that stage, and we walked out on that stage, and I just froze. It was so weird, and I was playing Rocky Top, so it wasn't like it mattered or it was hard, but it really set in on me in that moment, like, where am I? Like, how in the world did I get to be in this spot, on this stage, playing music, stupid music, but playing music in the place that the Beatles played, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, like, I was super into Jimi Hendrix when I was in high school, and just knowing that he had been there, played there, you know, destroyed his guitar or whatever he did there. Like, that was a moment that there is no other situation in my life where I will ever be on the stage at the Royal Albert Hall, probably. But my parents being willing to let me go be free and go do this thing and paying for it. Great. Surely it wasn't cheap, but you know, they made it possible for me to go have that moment that it was just crazy to me and has stuck with me. I think that's an awesome thing that as an adult, whether you're a parent or just an adult, you have the opportunity to allow or to make it possible for a younger person to have moments like that. Whether you're the one that's showing them how to build slingshots and you go to a camp and you make this memorable thing where they're like, I was at a camp and Jimmy DiResta was the person who he taught me how to blacksmith or he, you know, whatever. Like that is a moment that
yeah.
is going to stick with those kids. I mean, you're no Royal Albert Hall, but you're still pretty awesome. And in those kids' mind, like that's going to be a memorable moment for them. And we've all got the opportunity to do that for a bunch of kids or for one kid or something, but just to help people like have those moments that are going to be formative and stick with them, like, man, it's yeah. really cool. And it's cool that yeah. we get to do that. So
yeah, I did that video I talked about a couple weeks ago on the after show, the video about my dad and you know all the things I learned from him. And I learned all those moments. I mean, I remember all those moments I learned is what I should say. Mm. I remember those exact moments and they stick with me. They stick with all of us. And there are certain things when I was a kid, we didn't actually go to camp. At least I didn't. My brothers did because they stopped it by the time I was old enough to go. But Police Boys Club in Long Island is called PBC, Police Boys Club. And by the time I came around, it was just a couple nights a week at the local school. But prior to that, in the earlier years, they would take kids on a bus. And one of the counselors at PBC, who was a former police officer, had a house in upstate New York, and the kids, like 10 of them, would get on a bus and spend the weekend at Sam's house, and Sam would give them all chores to do, like cut all the grass over there. And they basically said they were like brought up, used for farmhand work. But at the same time, it was formative. They got a chance to actually see what the country was like. And I never personally did that, but I did go to PBC and the counselors there. It was basically basketball and softball and stuff, you know, just something to keep the kids busy at night, a couple of nights during the summer weekends. So that was the closest thing I did, but there was certainly things I learned from the older kids there. There was kids from as young as me. I remember on Halloween at PBC, they would bring us all into the auditorium at the school, and it was all in the evening, so the school was closed for regular school business, and they'd bring us in the evening. And on a big giant projector, they would play Nosferatu for Halloween.
Oh, gosh.
They'd have these big reels, these like 24-inch movie reels on 16-millimeter film. And they would play Nosferatu with no sound. And everybody would just be laughing at how like ridiculous. We're supposed to be scared at this? It's ridiculous. Yeah. And by the time I got to college and I'm studying Nosferatu and F.W. Murnau and in film class, I'm like, this is so funny. I know all about this already. Mm. It's crazy.
Yeah, talking about like them going and kind of being used as hired hands or whatever. I'm listening to this book right now that it's been many years since I've read. It's called Wild at Heart, and it's about men. Anyway, there's a story in it about the author grew up going to his grandfather's farm and in the summers, and so he would go spend time with his grandfather, and his grandfather would put him to work. And the guy was nice. He wasn't like a, you know, didn't overwork the kid, but he put the kid to work in the farm with him, alongside him. And so he tells the story about how they went in one time and they took a break in the middle of the day. They went in and got some tea and they're sitting in there. The grandfather looks out the window and he sees one of the cows got into this like alfalfa field or something, somewhere he shouldn't have been, that would be or she shouldn't have been, that would have been dangerous for the cow to continue to eat this thing. And so the grandfather was taking a break. He was having his iced tea. And he said something like, yeah, that cow shouldn't be there. Go get it. And then he sat down. And this kid, who was, I don't know, 11 or 12 or something, had the realization that he, to do what his grandfather had just trusted him to do, was a big part of it. He trusted him to be capable to go get a horse, saddle the horse, take the horse in, lasso the cow, pull the cow back to the right thing, and put the horse up and take the saddle off the horse. And as a young kid, he was like, he mentioned being terrified of all of those processes because he had never done them by himself. But his grandfather saw that he was capable of doing all those things and just trusted him to do it. And like that, I don't know, that says a lot, because, and when I'm thinking about my own kids and the things that I end up just doing for them because it's convenient, it's faster if I do it myself, but then they don't ever get the experience of me doing it with them. And so then it's not fair for me to ask them to go do it. So yesterday, my oldest son, his bike tires needed to be replaced on his bike. They were just like worn out and stuff. And I could get that done in 5 minutes, but it was like, let's go change your tires. And so I showed him how to change the front one. I showed him how to adjust the brakes to make them tighter. And I was like, okay, now you have the back to do. And he totally did it. And it's the same with all of the tool usage and stuff from this past week. He was empowered to do it on his own because I showed him how. I walked him through it once and then trusted him to do it. And now he can do that in the future. All of those kids that I worked with and can use a circular saw. They can use drill and driver. They understand what the difference is. They, you know, that basic stuff, they were trusted with doing the work. I was trusted with going to England. You know, you were trusted with going to the camp in Michigan. Like, those things are developmental for kids. The week was so exciting for me to see development in other people that I want to do more of that in person. Jimmy, maybe you're the same, but like, you know, we do things at a distance from people generally with our videos, and you can see impact, which is amazing that you can see impact for what we do in people's lives. They tell us about it and stuff. But to see it up close,
yeah,
personally, is a very, very different thing.
Just like I said earlier, when I watched the light go up, I could see it when I was a teacher, but to see it with young kids. Mm. When I was a teacher, I taught 20-year-olds for the most part. I could always see that moment in the ones that became really interested. I could see where the light goes on. And some of those kids where I watched that light go on when they were introduced to 3D world, because I taught 3D creation in a world of 2D art. So I was like an island of salvation in their curriculum. They would come to me to get their hands on clay and wood and plastic and resins versus just sitting at the computer all the time. So when they came to me, I could see the light go on and watch them get handed this pass to go and play. And then they would go and play. I mean, one student in particular comes to mind is this kid, David. I did the lamp class, and he went on to just constantly make lamps. I don't know where he is now. We've lost touch. But he made, for the next 5 years, just following him on social media and just seeing what he's doing, he's making lamps. And all because I showed him you can just go buy a kit at Home Depot and make your own lamp. And that's one example of many. But now with these kids, watching them take cardboard and play with cardboard and make prototypes, and which is what we did. We did rounds of cardboard. I didn't send you guys any of the video clips. I'll show them to you. Cutting up cardboard and gluing it together and making prototypes with masking tape and scissors and rubber bands. Yeah, it was great. You could just see the lights going on, which is really, yeah, really, really amazing.
Yeah, it is. Well, any other thoughts on this? Mm-hmm.
I have a question for for our listeners. Is I have this memory of an experience in elementary school that I can't prove that actually happened, but I seem to remember at my school getting a display of lunar rocks and moon dust. And it was in like this glass case or acrylic case by the principal's office. And it was a big deal. And you can go and you can see rocks from the moon. And that memory just popped into my head. So while you guys were talking, I was trying to Google it and I couldn't find anything. I see something in the UK called Borrow the Moon, which they've been doing since the 80s, but I couldn't find anything in the United States. So if there's any listeners of this podcast that can confirm that in the 80s, there was this traveling lunar experience where you could see a moon rock in your school, please confirm my memory. Because we seem to make up things as we get older. And I can't.
Yeah.
I want to know that it was real.
Yeah. You know, there's a bunch of stuff like that, though, in the 80s that I think now is, I don't know, it's prohibitively expensive or I don't know what the deal is, but I feel like there was a lot of that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like stuff was a little bit more freely passed around and accessible, and I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like a moon rock is probably too expensive to take to a crappy elementary school in a town of 500 people, you know?
Yeah, these days. Cool. Well, yeah, I guess, yeah. We'll thank our Patreon supporters. I've got a couple things to recommend today. So I'm already set up and ready to go. But big thanks to our Patreon supporters who are awesome and make it possible for us to talk about our memories and camping and making and all this stuff. We're very grateful for you all. Especially the top supporters, they go above and beyond. And that is Nick Ryan, Corey Ward, Albers Woodworks, Works by Solo, Chad from Mancrafting, Chad's Custom Creations, Rich at Low End Design, Odin Leather Goods, Sean Beckner, Scott at Daddy Yourself DIY, Jeff at the New Janky Workshop, Warren Works, Michael Menegin, and Crabtree Creative. But also people like Gordon F. Crago. Gordon. Thanks, Gordon.
Gordon.
I don't know how to say last name. I'm terrible with last names. Seriously, everybody over there at every level, we're grateful for you. You all get the after show. Had some more messages this week. Somebody was asking about the after show, how they get it. And it is a link on Patreon for an RSS feed that you can add to your, you can listen to it on Patreon, but you can put the RSS feed in your podcast player. You get the after show as a separate podcast. There's also links there for the YouTube, private videos. If you want to watch the after show in video, you can do that. So it's all there for you. Big thanks for the support. We appreciate it. And if you want to get that stuff, you can go to patreon.com/makingit and join up at any level. You get that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys have to recommend this
week? I'm going to recommend The Death of a Follower and the Future of Creativity on the Web. By Jack Conte Extras. Jack Conte Extras. And the reason it's something we talked about in the past a couple months ago. I guess it was around, when is it? South by Southwest, April usually. So we talked about it back then, but this time the video has all the visual aids that went along with the presentation. So you could watch and see all the, and somewhere in there is a picture of me. According to the people at Patreon, they sent me a message and said, you're in Jack Conte's. If you could find it, someone send me the time code of where I am, because I've been watching it, but I keep forgetting to look at the I just keep listening and turning my head away.
It's like when you watch a movie. You can't just watch a movie.
Yeah.
No. I have to do seven things. I can't just focus. No.
You should get Apple Vision just for that. So that do other things, but the movie is like always right in your way and follow you around as you do things.
That kind of peaked and went away. Those white goggles. They were everywhere. Now you don't see them at all.
It'll be a couple generations before there's something useful enough for it to keep showing back up, I think.
By the way, I got a good after show thing to tell you.
Right. Oh,
okay. I might only be able to tell you part of it, but then when we turn the mics off, I'll tell you the rest of it.
Oh, okay.
You got to pay for the after show.
Dark there's after show. There is often secret stuff in the after show. So for those listening, all right, David, what you
got? I got some. All right, so I have a little announcement. Something I'm proud of. I'll talk about in the after show. All right, so my pick is this artist, and I think it's pronounced David Choe, Choe. He has this video called Embrace Fearlessness, and his channel's only got 89,000 subscribers. I say only, that's a huge number of people, but he's a great artist. His studio, I don't know if it's his actual studio, but if you start playing this video, he is in a kitchen, but the walls are all graffitied and everything. It's all crazy and there's just paint drips everywhere. So I don't know if this is, if he's creating art where he lives and his kitchen is just this crazy disaster, or if he has a separate place where he does all his art. But he is my pick. His humor might rub people the wrong way, which I enjoy. Something is beeping. What the heck is going on? Oh, so side note. So this is I listened to you guys through my AirPods, and I couldn't find my AirPods earlier. So I did find mine with the little Apple app.
Found them.
That was an hour and 45 minutes ago, and for some reason they just now went off. Yeah. That's cool. All right. So Embrace Fearlessness by David Cho. Cool little channel.
Cool. So I have two, and they're both people I've talked about before. The first one is, we talked about Bo Miles, the Australian guy that has some really cool videos. He put out a video recently that it's just interesting. It's called I'm Sick, and turns out he had pneumonia for a year. And so the video is about him not realizing that he had pneumonia and still doing like ultra marathon training, which is ridiculous by itself. But he's been sick and he's been running through it. Just thought he had like colds and stuff, and he's had pneumonia and he got it. It went away and he got it again. And so that it's wild. The thing that was really funny about it though, is there's this bit in the middle of the video where he says, like, I'm not a bath person. Like taking a bath is kind of like soaking in your own soup, I think is what he called it. It's like a very, he calls it like a medieval thing, like to take a bath, which is kind of true. It's kind of gross. But he found himself taking a bath because he felt so bad. And he was like, for me, doing that meant that I was physically, a fly just flew into my hair and then landed on my shirt.
Everything is just going wrong now.
Here, anyway. Physically, it was a low point. He realized that he felt so bad that he was willing to take a bath to try to feel better. And it was just like an interesting thing to realize, to get to a point physically where you realize you need to get some help or get it checked out or whatever. But anyway, I hope he's getting better. Just a wild thing to hear that you have pneumonia for a year and still do the amount of training and running and craziness that he does as well. Anyway, so that's one. The other one is, remember we talked about Ronald Finger, the Ronald Finger channel a long time ago. He rebuilt a Fiero.
Oh yeah,
do you remember that? Like the red Fiero. Well, I watched some of those videos, the Fiero, but I didn't watch the whole restoration. I realized that I had never subbed to the channel, but it popped up. His channel popped up, and it's we were talking a few weeks ago about the 280Zs, the Datsun car, and how like they're in my head, and I'm fighting the urge to buy another dead car. So this video popped up from several months ago where he has a 280Z, which I didn't realize, and it hadn't run in 21 years. So this video is all about him getting it running and getting it to pass inspection so he can get it registered and stuff. It's such a good video. It's like, it covers a whole bunch of stuff, the improvements he made, the things he fixed, but it's funny. And he has this interesting mixture of voiceover and talking to camera that is kind of like what you were saying earlier, David, about the voiceover being the, like, he filmed the process and talked a little bit, but then the voiceover is the thing that glues the story together. And maybe he's always done that. I don't know. I haven't watched enough of the videos to know, but that stuck out to me watching this one, that it was a good mechanism for taking a whole bunch of work done over several months and turning it into one story. Anyway, it was a lot of fun to watch. And I went to follow him and realized he was following me. So
Which video?
That felt pretty nice. It's called Fixing the 280Z That's Been Dead for 21 Years.
Okay.
1.8 million views.
Yeah. That's a good video, though. Not bad.
See, you know what? You know why that did so well? That did so well because he has a really interesting title.
You think so? It's pretty down the middle.
I'm kidding.
Yeah.
These. It's like, anyway, is this gonna kill me? Like, that would have been a better title.
Yeah, yeah. 80 things I found inside this old car. Yeah.
Always have to have a number in the title with a question mark at the end.
Anyway, those are both good things you should check out. You guys got anything else for this week?
That's it.
I'm going to be traveling again next week, so no show again.
Oh, there you go.
But I'm not going to tell you where I'm going, but I'll tell you later. Right.
Okay.
Cool.
Awesome.
We'll see you in a couple weeks. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Love you. Love you more.